Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for April 8th, 2011. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, the connection between physical disorder and stereotyping, keeping genetically modified and organic crops separated, and new insights into the internal structure of distant stars. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how sex led to a scientific first from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Stereotyping and the discriminatory behavior it leads to is not always such a bad thing. It can keep you from walking alone down a stereotypical dark alley where trouble may await. But discriminatory behavior among people in public situations can actually cause trouble, inciting riots and other kinds of violence. Now, research in a paper in this week's Science suggests that one stimulus that prompts people to stereotype is disorder. Whether clutter in a room, cracks in a sidewalk, even geometric shapes arranged haphazardly. Sigurd Lindenberg and Diedrich Stoppel report that people stereotyped more and even exhibited more discriminatory behavior when in a disordered environment. And it made no difference what mood these people were in, whether they were distracted with some other task or were male or female. I spoke with Lindenberg from his office at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands.
Very little disorder already in the environment can make people discriminate more than in orderly environments, so that the stereotypes that underlie discrimination become activated just through, let's say, a garbage bag or garbage on the ground. And that is the upshot of what we have found.
What, if any, prior research prompted you and your co-author, Diedrich Stoppel, to test this idea that physical disorder leads to increased stereotyping and so even discriminatory behavior?
Well, we had some prior research by Stoppel himself that showed that people do not always stereotype to the same degree, and that it looked as if, indeed, a need for order may be connected to stereotyping. But we weren't quite sure of the causal connection, and we weren't quite sure whether indeed it is just any kind of disorder or whether it is a particular kind of disorder or what. But we had some hint that there may be a connection, and so we went to explore that in a number of experiments in the field and then in the lab. And in the lab, we did experiments that really focused on the mechanism behind this effect.
What happened in these field experiments first?
Well, we had two field experiments, one in a station. We were lucky enough that the garbage men were on strike for quite a while, and the station in a Dutch city became very dirty and covered with trash, a very busy train station. And so there, we took the opportunity to use that as our condition of disorder. And we had six chairs lined up, and we asked people to fill in a questionnaire, and this questionnaire was about their opinions about minorities, Muslim, homosexuals, and Dutch, or I should say three groups, two of which were minorities. And in order to fill that in, they had to sit down, and we had placed a stooge. So a stooge is a person who works with us, who seems to be just like another person that is asked to fill in a questionnaire. And that person sat already on one chair on one side. And the question now was, how far away would a person who sits down to fill in a questionnaire, how far away from that person already sitting there would the person be seated? And our hypothesis was that in a clean condition, there isn't much difference between a white and a black person for white people. And in a dirty trash condition, white people would sit significantly further away from the black person than from a white person.
So the confidant, the stooge, as you say, was either a white person or a black person, and then
was
you tested
either a white person or a black person.
And then you tested people who were in the train station, and these were all white.
We tested only Caucasians.
Okay.
Yeah, and the reason that we assumed that they would sit further away is that we hypothesized that the disorder would increase their tendency to stereotype, all sorts of groups, and stereotypes about minorities are, especially in public places, are by and large negative. So they may have some stereotypes that are positive, but in general there's also a stereotype, this may be dangerous and sit further away. And indeed, this is exactly what we found. There was a significant difference in the two conditions. In the orderly condition, they sat equally close to a white or a black person. And in the disorderly condition, they sat significantly further away from the black person than from the white person.
And you said there were two field experiments?
Yes. The second field experiment was in a very prosperous neighborhood in another Dutch city where we did the following. Dutch sidewalks are often tiled with concrete tiles, and we took a number of these tiles out and just put them in a very disorderly fashion, let them lie there. Then we parked a car with a front wheel on the sidewalk, and we had a bicycle lying there, half on the sidewalk, half on the street, to create the impression of disorder. And then as people were walking by, we asked them to fill in the same questionnaire about the stereotypes about Muslims, homosexuals, and the Dutch. And this time we would give them €5 in small coins as a reward. And at the end of filling in the questionnaire, we asked them whether they would like to donate some of that money to a fund for the improvement of the condition of minorities in the Netherlands. And that was our behavioral measure for discrimination. So we had predicted, and we found, that in the disorderly condition, people did not just stereotype a lot more, they also gave a lot less. So just as we found in the train station, stereotyping went up and discrimination also went up. And mind you, in the train station, it was clear that the questionnaire was about different groups than blacks. So it just spreads the prejudice, or I should say the stereotyping spreads to all sorts of groups. So it's a general stereotyping effect.
So with these field experiments, you got at this apparent connection between disorder and stereotyping, and so even discriminatory behavior.
Yes.
Back in the lab, you said there were a few more experiments. What questions were you trying to answer with these experiments to really try and show that it was physical disorder leading to this stereotyping?
Right. So first of all, we wanted to be sure that it is indeed not dirtiness. So I should just add that. That's why we did the second field experiment. The first field experiment was messy, but it could have been simply the dirt, that people get disgusted by the dirt rather than the sheer disorder. So that's why we did the second field experiment with the tiles. In the lab, we wanted to go further to find out about the mechanism by testing whether it is indeed true that, as we surmised, that the disorder increases a need for order. And it is the need for order that is satisfied by thinking more in black and white terms, in stereotypes. These are very simplifying categories that you then think in about other social groups, and that creates a certain degree of order. And we wanted to see, first of all, is it true that the need for order goes up with disorder around you? And it does. We measured the need for order, and we compared then the conditions with regard to the need for order, and indeed the need for order increases through disorder just as discrimination and stereotyping does. And then we wanted to find out whether indeed it is the need for order that really is the causal mechanism behind it, or maybe it just also goes up like the others, or maybe it's really the causal factor. And we found out that indeed it is the need for order that creates this effect. We could show that after discriminating, the need for order went down. So first of all, the need for order really mediated the effect. There are some statistical techniques to find out that you have disorder leading to heightened need for order, and that leads to more stereotyping. And so that the direct link between disorder and stereotyping vanishes if you put in the need for order, because it runs via the need for order. There are some statistical techniques to use that to find out that indeed this is the causal link. And we indeed found out that stereotyping is a way of dealing with disorder. It's an effective way of dealing with disorder, because the need for order is reduced after one has just stereotyped. So this is what we did in the lab experiments.
You said in the train station experiment that you only tested white people. Did you repeat these experiments and find similar results with different ethnic or cultural groups?
No, we did not. This was a unique opportunity by the strike of the garbage men, and we had not another such occasion to test this. So the tests were done only with whites, also in the lab.
You mentioned one of your conclusions, this need for order goes up with disorder around you. What, if any, evolutionary selective pressure is there for coping with physical chaos by stereotyping?
Well, of course, we're not sure whether there were selective pressures with regard to that, but one could imagine that once you go to a mode where you use very simple categories, that you will act much faster. So is that person dangerous or is that person not dangerous, that you will cut out a lot of detail, a lot of possibilities. Well, let's see, let's find out more. We believe that indeed there is an evolutionary explanation, in the sense that situations that are unstructured, that increase the need for order, have often been dangerous situations, situations that you couldn't quite structure right away what is going on. And in such situations, it is of survival value to use very simple categories that cover basically not the individual before you, but the cue you have about the membership of that individual.
Sigwart Lindenberg, thank you very much.
Well, okay, thank you very much for calling.
Sigwart Lindenberg of the University of Groningen is co-author of a paper in this week's Science on how disordered contexts promote stereotyping and discrimination.
This story is about the tension between organic farmers and biotech farmers, how research can help the two coexist side by side, and some of the political difficulties that remain in working out all the differences.
Science's Eric Stockstead reports in this week's issue on the coexistence of organic and biotech farms and keeping the crops separated.
Coexistence is an old idea. It's about how farmers who are doing different things in the same area can both grow their crops and thrive without one adversely impacting the other. So that's the principle. Farmers have been dealing with this issue for a long time. Pesticide drift, livestock that gets out of one field and tramples your neighbor's alfalfa field. What's different about biotechnology, about genetically modified crops, is one, that there's a lot of consumer reluctance out there in some places, in some communities. So if genes from a genetically modified crop drift from one field where you're growing biotech corn over to the neighboring organic farmer, and those transgenes end up in his corn, the concern is that that corn might not be able to be sold as organic to a buyer who doesn't want transgenes in their cornflakes. And the other thing that's slightly different now is that it's pretty easy to test for these transgenes. You can test a sample and you can find very low concentrations of these transgenes. And they find them. These genes spread around, and they are found in organic fields. They're found in shipments that go to Europe.
And right now, who pays to keep the organic produce organic, free from transgenes?
Right now in the U.S., it's the organic farmer. And the reason is our de facto policy in the U.S. is that it's the responsibility of the organic farmer to keep out the transgenes. It's not the responsibility of the biotech farmer to keep them in. So essentially, the organic farmer has to find a way to fence out the transgenes. The problem for the organic farmer who finds transgenes when they show up in that field is not so much the organic label, because in the U.S., what the label means is that the organic farmer has followed a set of rules. And the rule is, for genetically modified crops, is you can't plant them. So if you're growing organic corn, you can't grow genetically modified corn. But if transgenes from your neighbor's biotech corn drift into your field, that's not your fault. You can still label that corn as organic. In the United States, that's what our label means. But if you want to sell that corn to Europe, and their policy is no transgenes in our corn, then you have an export problem. So you might lose your market. You might not be able to sell that corn as premium to a buyer in another country, or to a buyer in this country that says, no transgenes, please. We're going to test you. You have transgenes in your corn. You can't get that premium to that discriminating buyer.
At present, how are genetically modified and organic crops kept from mixing?
There are several things that organic farmers do. One is that they plant a buffer strip so that their field is edged with corn that they're not planting as organic. So if transgenic corn pollen drifts 10 meters into their field, no problem. They're planning on selling that as regular corn, not as premium organic corn. The other thing that they can do is plant their crop at a slightly different time. So the corn next door is putting off pollen at a time when your corn is not ready to receive pollen. So you have a difference in planting times. Another thing that sometimes happens is you may have your farm in a place where not much biotech corn is grown. So you might grow your organic corn in a part of the state which isn't great for growing corn, and that's why there's not a lot of biotech corn around. So I mean, you can have geographic isolation.
So at least with corn, the concern is pollen, and I imagine with other crops, even seeds might transport long distances with the wind. 10 meters, 100 meters, another state. I mean, don't pollen and seeds sometimes travel across oceans even?
You're absolutely right, and there are a lot of ways for genes to get mixed up. One is with pollen. So if you have a genetically modified crop, the pollen from that plant with those transgenes can drift in the wind or be taken by your friend the honeybee, depending on the crop, and transferred into a field of organic crops. The other thing that can happen is you grow your biotech corn and you harvest it. You now have a truck and then a silo full of biotech corn. Next door, the organic farmer is also harvesting corn, and those kernels end up in a truck and go to a silo. You can have mixing along the way. If you have a farmer who's doing both, growing biotech corn at some times and organic corn at another, they're using the same equipment perhaps. Things can linger in the combine. There's a lot of way that seeds can get mixed up. And a really dramatic example of that is when you have experimental varieties of a crop, corn, rice, that haven't been approved yet, only experimental, and then you find them in the food supply. And that happened 10, 11 years ago with what was called Starlink corn, a corn that was approved for animal feed, but not for human feed. And even though there were processes in place to keep those separate, they got thoroughly mixed, found in taco shells, found throughout the food supply. And it happened just a couple of years ago with the biotech rice that wasn't approved yet. Millions and millions of dollars of lawsuits over that mix-up.
So it sounds like zero tolerance for any mixing is pretty much out of the question.
Zero is really hard. Most scientists say it's pretty impossible. You can imagine that if you're growing a crop in a country where there are no approved varieties, then you might be able to get pretty close. But seed moves around the world, so zero is pretty hard to achieve.
So what, if any, future plans are there for keeping genetically modified and organic crops from mixing?
One idea is to give organic farmers plants that can't be pollinated by a biotech crop.
So breed them in traditional ways.
In fact, there are plants like that already. And this is where the idea comes from. Decades ago, scientists noticed that some varieties of corn had a very special property. They could only be pollinated by the same type of corn, that same variety. This has been used in popcorn. So popcorn is a special type of corn. It's a specialty corn. If you're growing popcorn, you don't want it to be pollinated by dent corn, by other field corn that's going to be fed to animals, because you lose the special properties that makes popcorn pop. So the genetics are fairly complicated about why this is, but researchers have taken those genes from those varieties of popcorn and bred them using traditional breeding techniques into varieties of corn, regular corn, that organic farmers would grow to serve an organic market. The neat thing is you plant these types of corn, they're not going to be pollinated by biotech corn, even if it's across the fence.
But it works both ways, right? I mean, these plants could pollinate the genetically modified plants.
That's right. And when they do, that special gene ends up in the biotech corn.
And so it could pollinate essentially back.
That's the potential weakness. Exactly. So it's not a permanent solution. But that hasn't stopped researchers from working on this approach. And the first commercial varieties of this corn is going to be available to organic farmers this fall.
So will the idea be then for biotech crop farmers to keep this gene essentially out of their biotech crops? Or there's no incentive for them?
There's no incentive for them to do that.
So you've given me one example with this pollen and the gene in corn. Is there any consensus that any of these types of future techniques, real or imagined, for keeping genetically modified and organic crops from mixing will work long term?
It's very hard to imagine that you'd come up with a perfect solution, and a perfect solution that would last forever. That's why researchers keep coming back to this idea of having a threshold for acceptability, of saying we can't promise zero transgenes. So come up with an amount, a small amount, 0.1%, 1%, that everyone will agree is acceptable. And when you do that, then you can start to figure out isolation distances and other recommendations that will make that possible almost all the time.
And until that agreement, more lawsuits, at least here in the United States?
Yes, that's very likely, because there are still groups that are very passionately, philosophically opposed to genetically modified crops, and they'll keep suing.
Eric Stockstead, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob.
Science's Eric Stockstead reports in this week's issue on the coexistence of organic and biotech farms and keeping the crops separated. Also in this week's Science, happy 100th superconductivity. In a special section in this week's issue, read about 100 years of research on superconductivity since it was originally discovered in April 1911. To review articles, look at exotic superconductors, and to news articles, make clear that superconductivity and the theory behind it have enriched basic science in ways that nobody could have foreseen. A century on, for more reasons than ever before, physicists and material scientists remain enthralled with the observations of disappearing electrical resistance. Read about it in this week's Science. Scientists use NASA's Kepler Space Telescope to look for Earth-like planets by recording tiny changes in the brightness of stars as objects pass in front of them. But many of the brightness variations measured by Kepler represent variations in the stars themselves, rather than any passing planet. Our Sun, for example, has a million or so of these periodic variations, perhaps the best known of which is the solar maximum that happens about every 11 years. Now, there are many different mechanisms that drive these solar oscillations, with the bubbling convective motion of the plasma perhaps the most important in understanding the structure of our Sun. Those oscillations shake the Sun like a bell that never stops ringing, and analyzing them allows researchers to study the interior of the Sun in much the same way that seismic waves allow geologists to study the interior of the Earth. Of course, scientists cannot get the same kind of data from other stars as they can from our Sun because of the vast distances the light has to travel, and because Kepler is sampling light from 100,000 stars. But with the data Kepler has, three teams report in this week's Science results that provide new insights and raise new questions about the internal structure of distant stars. Michael Montgomery writes a perspective in this week's Science about all three papers, and I spoke with him from his office at the University of Texas at Austin.
We're able to make a lot of these same inferences for other stars. We can get out several aspects, like what their real age is, what their real composition is, what their rotation profile is like, things like that.
So Kepler is sampling these stars often enough and has for long enough to pick up the variations, at least some of them, hundreds of them, that are observed in our sun.
Exactly. The technical term is astero-seismology, and that means you're making a match between models of the stars and the stars themselves. So you build a model of the star, you know, numerically, and then you say, okay, well, this particular model, what frequencies would it pulsate with? And you calculate a whole list of ones that it could pulsate with. And then you look at the actual star, and you say, okay, what frequencies is it pulsating at? And you have a list. And you simply try to match those two lists together. And when the frequencies are off a little bit, you go back to your model and you say, okay, well, maybe I can change something in my model, like make it slightly more massive or slightly hotter. And then that'll bring the frequencies into agreement. And so it's kind of an iterative process between you build a model of the star and you try to explain the data that you're looking at.
To what extent are the observations in these three papers matching the models?
Well, in the paper by Chaplin et al., they took a large sample of stars, which really allow you to do much better statistics. You know, because not all stars are the same, but what you really want to know are what are the group properties of the stars. And so what they did is they looked at the pulsations of 500 stars, and they applied what I would call some, gosh, I don't want to use the word heuristic, but some simpler criteria, which are reliable, to derive the masses and the radii of these objects. And I want to emphasize that these masses and radii come from the pulsations themselves. They don't come from taking a spectrum of the star and trying to figure out how hot the star is and then using a stellar model to say, oh, this star must be this mass and this temperature. It really is just using the pulsation data and saying what you can say with just the pulsation data. So it's an independent technique of getting masses and radii. So what they found by using this technique is that the distribution of radii for these 500 objects was what they expected, but that the distribution of masses was not. Now, when we say distribution of masses, what we mean is, you know, stars form from collapsing gas clouds, and there's a distribution of masses. Some are 0.5 solar masses, some are 1, some are 2, 3, 4, 5. As you go to higher masses, there are few stars. Most stars are low mass, around 0.8 or something. And so you're going to have a distribution. And we think we know what that distribution of masses is because we've independently measured it for a large set of stars. What these results find is a slightly different distribution of masses, more weighted toward the lower mass side than the higher mass side. The strange part is that the radii of this sample of objects is what you would expect, is what has been measured before. You know, if that were different too, then you'd say, okay, well, maybe there's just some systematic difference here. But if you take both of these sets of data at face value, it says we predict the radii of stars correctly, and yet we predict their mass is wrong. And what that would mean is that the mass-radius relationship for a given star would be different than what we think theoretically. And that would actually be a rather big deal.
Saying, because it says also something perhaps about the composition of the star, or?
No, what that would really say is that our main models of the stars, you know, if you give us a mass, the radius we calculate for our models is wrong. Now, I personally don't think the answer is quite that simple, but it definitely points in the direction that, yes, maybe there's something missing from our models. And you're right, one of the things could be composition. It could be the way we treat convection in these objects, because convection is sort of a free parameter. It could be composition or mixing in these models. I'd have to say at this point that it's really kind of unknown what the source of this discrepancy is.
Okay. How about the other two papers then?
Okay. Let's see. The second one. So this paper by Beck et al., what they found is the normal pressure mode oscillations that we see in the sun, they found in red giant stars. Then they found other frequencies that didn't really fit the pattern very well, and they were able to make a very good argument that those additional frequencies were due to gravity modes and not pressure modes. So they're fundamentally different processes. Having both in the same star allows you to learn different things about the interior of the star. And it turns out in these stars, we think that the gravity modes, their vibrations go way down into the core, deeper than the pressure modes do. So by having these gravity modes in addition to these pressure modes, one can potentially measure things about the red giant core, which one couldn't measure otherwise. The red giant structure is very unconstrained, and so measuring things about the core will really be valuable in the future.
And so for this final paper, what are the pulsations observed by Kepler say?
Well, the surprising thing about this third paper by Derricus et al., they observed a rather exotic system that, again, does have a red giant in it, but surprisingly in this case, no pulsations have been found. And this is really quite a mystery. However, it's not the most remarkable thing about this system. The system that they looked at is actually a triple star system with a red giant, and then orbiting that red giant is a pair of stars that you can think of as a tight binary. So you have a tight binary composed of two stars orbiting each other, and that binary itself orbits the red giant. And so it's a triple star system. And okay, so that's very interesting, but that's not unique. The thing that makes this really unique is that every component in the system is eclipsing. So the two stars, the binary, pass in front of the red giant and behind it. And the two stars pass in front of each other, so they eclipse themselves and they eclipse the red giant. And so this sort of, you know, multi-component, multi-eclipse system is really quite unique.
And you said the red giant doesn't have any pulsations. Are they being potentially canceled out by the pulsations of the others?
That is a very interesting question. They're probably not being canceled out by the pulsations of the other stars, but I think they must be being suppressed somehow by being in this strange orbital setup. It's certainly the smoking gun. I mean, when you look at isolated red giant stars, they pretty much always pulsate at this level. And here we have one that isn't isolated, that's in a rather, you know, strange orbital configuration. It's certainly natural to think that it has something to do with the fact that it doesn't pulsate. But I'd also be lying if I told you I knew exactly why that was the case. Since these stars are so close to each other, there may well have been interactions in the past that involved transferring mass between different components in the system. And so this red giant might not be like other red giants for which that hasn't occurred. But again, I can't say for sure. It is a bit of a mystery, and I'm quite puzzled by it.
So with continuing observations helping to learn more, capturing pulsations, oscillations on a longer time scale, or is what's needed a future space mission or a ground-based project?
Yeah, you mean where do we go next after Kepler?
Or just with Kepler itself, having a longer time frame of data.
Yeah, it's a good point. So Kepler has been in orbit for about 2 years, but, you know, the first part of its mission was, you know, calibrating the spacecraft, making sure everything was working perfectly. And so we're hoping to start to be able to see things that only become apparent when you have multi-years of data on single objects. You know, for instance, the Sun has a solar cycle of 11 years where the magnetic field reverses and you get more sunspots and then fewer sunspots. We hope to see evidence of this in the pulsations of some of these stars, to see solar cycles that we can tease out. Now, obviously, that requires a longer time baseline, but Kepler has more years that it'll be up, and I'm quite hopeful that its mission will be extended beyond the initial 3.5-year phase. I don't know what that would be, but I know that NASA will be thinking along these lines and will want to extend the mission. Plus, you know, Kepler is also looking for planets. And, you know, if you're looking for a planet that takes 3 years to go around its star, then you need a 3-year mission so that you're sensitive to timescales that are longer. And so by extending its mission, I think we will get out much more science than we've even gotten out so far. It really makes sense to continue these observations for the coming years.
Mike Montgomery, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Robert.
Mike Montgomery of the University of Texas at Austin and Delaware Astroseismic Research Center on observations with the Kepler Space Telescope and what they reveal about the internal structure of distant stars. Find Montgomery's perspective and the three papers he mentioned in this week's Science. Finally today, David Graham, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now, including a story about how sex led to a scientific first. Are we talking about the first time there was sex, Dave, or something else?
No, Rob, we're talking about sex between two people, namely two of the authors on this new paper, and how that has led to a new understanding about how mosquitoes can transmit disease.
You've got a lot to clear up here, Dave. What does that mean?
This is a pretty complicated but very fascinating story. What happened was that a few years ago, a couple of researchers went to Senegal to study malaria mosquitoes there. And when they came back to the United States, they came down with some pretty unpleasant symptoms. They had a rash on their torso, extreme fatigue, headaches, swollen and painful wrists, and they weren't really sure what was going on. And before they could figure it out, one of the researchers' wife also came down with those symptoms. And she hadn't gone to Senegal. None of the researchers' children developed the symptoms. It was just him, the person he went to Senegal with, and his wife, who developed it a few days after he returned. And this became a really big mystery. And the researchers went to have themselves tested. They wondered if they had malaria or something else. And they had their blood tested. And when the results came back, they suggested that the two researchers had dengue fever, which can cause similar symptoms, but that the wife didn't. So this was still a mystery. How could the wife have developed it? There's really not mosquitoes that spread dengue in this part of the U.S., which is in Colorado. So this remained a mystery for a few years. The researchers really weren't sure what they had. They weren't sure what the wife had. They weren't sure how she got whatever she had. Their symptoms had long gone away, but the mystery persisted. And then a chance meeting between one of the researchers, the one who didn't have a wife that came down with the infection, and somebody else who was an expert in a disease known as Zika, resulted in a retesting of their blood samples, which the researchers had actually saved. And lo and behold, all the blood samples came back positive for this Zika virus, which is this really rare virus that can cause very similar symptoms. The reason the researchers think they initially tested positive for dengue is because some of the antibodies between Zika and dengue can cross-react. So this solved part of the mystery, what they had, but it still left open the question of how did the wife get this Zika virus, which is even more rare and clearly not the kind of thing that you would find in Colorado.
So the idea is that the researchers picked it up not by sex in Senegal, but by mosquito transmission, and then the researcher passed it on to his wife when he got home.
Right. That's the implication of this new study, that the researcher passed it on to his wife via sex. Now, they don't have proof of this, but there's very strong circumstantial evidence. The first thing is that Zika is just not common at all in Colorado. Also, the wife developed symptoms very quickly. If she had been bitten by a mosquito, or if she had been bitten by a mosquito that also bit her husband and transmitted the disease to her, it probably would have taken about 2 weeks for her to develop symptoms, but she developed symptoms in just 9 days. So the math didn't add up if it was anything other than sex. And yes, the researcher confirms that he did have relations with his wife very soon after returning from Senegal. So although it's not direct proof, there seems to be strong evidence that the researcher passed the Zika virus to his wife. And so what's exciting about this paper, aside from the fact that it was this really interesting mystery and this bit of a racy topic, what's really exciting is that researchers have never seen evidence before that a disease passed on from a mosquito can be sexually transmitted between people. And that's actually very important to epidemiologists. There was actually a Zika outbreak in 2007 in Yap, which is an island in the Federated States of Micronesia. And the disease spread a lot faster and hit people in a younger age bracket than researchers would have originally suspected. It also infected a lot more women than the researchers would have thought. And if the virus was actually sexually transmitted, it would explain a lot of what epidemiologists saw in this outbreak, and it could help them understand future outbreaks as well.
Now, you said this transmission from mosquito to human and then from human to human is new. Have researchers identified mosquito to another host and from that host to one of its own species before? Or is this completely new?
Well, this is the first evidence in humans, but actually researchers have seen something similar in boars where the males were infected with a virus and they transmitted it to females via sex. So that means that this type of transmission could be more common than we thought.
Okay. Thanks, Dave. So what other stories have we brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from mosquitoes to another annoying insect, lice, this next story is about what lice can tell us about the evolution of birds and mammals.
When they began feeding on us, or what?
Well, it's a little bit more ancient than that. This story has to do with a mass extinction known as the Cretaceous-Tertiary extinction, or the KT extinction, that happened 65 million years ago. And this was the big extinction that wiped out nearly all of the dinosaurs. And after this happened, mammals and birds really began to flourish, and we're probably here today because of that mass extinction. But there's been a big debate among scientists about whether the ancestors of these early mammals and birds actually survived this KT extinction, or whether they really just started to arise after the extinction had taken place. And the reason lice enter the picture is because lice have been around for over 100 million years. And if researchers could show that there were lice around at this time that were adapted to feeding on birds and mammals, that would suggest that there were birds and mammals around at this very early period in history.
Because the lice themselves hadn't evolved in 100 million years to feed on something else, or what?
Well, it's a little bit more complicated. Basically, what the researchers did in this study was they took two fossil lice, one that was 44 million years old and the other that was 100 million years old, and they did something called creating a molecular clock, trying to figure out how they evolved over time, how they changed. Now, some of these early lice did not feed on other animals, so the trick was figuring out when this adaptation to feed on animals like birds and mammals evolved, and it theoretically only would have evolved if these animals were around, because otherwise, why would lice have adapted to feeding on these animals? And what the researchers found was that these parasitic lice, the lice that feed on other animals, arose about at least 115 million years ago, which means that it's very possible that the ancestors of birds and mammals were also around at this time, and that they indeed were around to survive this KT extinction event.
But weren't the ancestors of birds dinosaurs?
That's a very good point, Rob. And as you know, scientists think that some of these dinosaurs had feathers, much like birds do. And the evolutionary analysis of these lice suggested that the earliest lice to feed on mammals probably fed on a bird-like creature, which could mean that dinosaurs, or at least these bird-like dinosaurs, may have helped spread lice to mammals.
So what's the broader picture here? What are researchers really going for?
Well, they're really trying to figure out how birds and mammals evolved. And because there was this really dramatic event, this KT extinction, this could have played a very big role in their evolution. So trying to figure out exactly when these animals came on the scene can tell us a lot about how we got here.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, this last story, we're also going to be going back into the past, but not so far back into the past. We're going to be going back to ancient Egypt about 3,500 years ago. And this story is about the development of atherosclerosis, which is the hardening of the arteries in ancient Egyptians.
Written about in hieroglyphics or what?
Somewhat written about in hieroglyphics. In fact, some hieroglyphics suggest that some of the ancient Egyptian nobility had not the healthiest diets. They seem to have fed on calorie-rich fare like cakes sweetened with honey. And because they had these kinds of diets, researchers have long wondered, did they have the same type of heart disease that we have? Now, the ancient Egyptians didn't have a lot of the ills in their society that we have today, things like smoking and air pollution, which can also contribute to atherosclerosis. But diet plays a big part. And so in this new study, researchers wanted to figure out how prevalent was atherosclerosis in these ancient Egyptians. And so what they did was they conducted the broadest and most detailed study yet of atherosclerosis in Egyptian mummies. They perform CT scans, which is a kind of medical scan, which really lets you peer inside the body on 52 mummies. And what they found was that 45% of these mummies exhibited definite or probable hardening of the arteries, which is a really high percentage.
These are soft tissues and they could still see this thousands of years later?
They can with the CT scan technology.
So could the researchers puzzle out that it was the diet or something else?
They couldn't puzzle out that it was the diet, although they suspect that definitely played a role. But the ancient Egyptians had another problem, which we don't have as much today, or at least we in developed countries don't have as much today, say, which is they were dealing with a lot of bacterial infection and infectious disease, which they couldn't treat. And these kinds of diseases cause inflammation in the body. And doctors today know that inflammation can contribute to the development of atherosclerosis. So even though the ancient Egyptians didn't have all of the ills that we deal with in society today, they had their own problems. And those ills seem to have contributed to many of the same health problems that we have today.
At least among the nobility who were mummified.
Exactly.
Any reason to think these people might have all been related to one another and there was a genetic component?
That's possible. But the other thing about nobility is they probably had access to a lot more of this high-calorie food than people that weren't in the nobility. So that might be further evidence that diet played a large role in the atherosclerosis that the researchers saw.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about how genetics may influence how much caffeine you drink, and also a story about growing eyeballs in the laboratory. Now, these aren't full eyeballs, but they're enough of an eyeball that they could be used to treat blindness and other ailments in the future. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we're continuing to follow the debate about the U.S. budget in Congress and what effect that could have on scientific research in the U.S. And also, we're continuing our coverage of the disaster in Japan, some new insights into how the radiation is spreading and what impact it's having on the soil in Japan and the surrounding ocean. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Graham is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the April 8th, 2011 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.